yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today, the news of the week, I think that's the most important news, is the surge in the global bond markets. What does that mean? That means bond prices are rising rapidly everywhere. That means interest rates, the yields on bonds are collapsing. Well, why is that? And why is it important? Well, it means that investors are rushing into bonds, the safety of bonds. And they're pulling their money out of other assets, particularly markets, because they know that the global economy recession is coming closer. So the money is flowing out into the bond market, the safety of the bond market, which is driving bond prices up and interest rates or yields on bonds down. That's why we have this yield curve situation. What's the yield curve? We talked about it before. Well, it's the spread between short-term bond rates and long-term bond rates. You know, that's the yield. The rate is the yield. And when the spread narrows or flattens, as they say, between the long and the short, in other words, they both converge, that's a pure flattening when they're both the same, that portends recession. Now, there's different kinds of short-term, long-term bonds you can look at. In the U.S., of course, if you look at two-year bonds and five-year bonds, they've already inverted. Inversion means where the long-term falls below the rate of the short-term. They've already inverted, the two-year and five-year. Okay? And just recently, we've had the inversion, and that spooked the bond markets here, investors into the bonds. We had the three-month and the 10-year bond invert. Three-month treasuries and 10-year treasuries. The 10-year treasury now is yielding an interest rate less than the three-month. Well, that three-month, 10-year, that curve, that yield curve, and, you know, you could have all kinds of curves between, you know, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10-year, 30-year, whatever. There's all potential kinds of yield curves. But the three-month, 10-year curve, which is now inverted, 10 years paying less than 3 months, that's the one that the Federal Reserve looks at. That's the key, you might say. And now that's inverted. All right, what that represents is that investors see the economy slowing around the corner significantly more than short-term rates, which the Fed, the Federal Reserve, you know, has some influence over. Central banks can influence short-term rates by pumping money in or out of the economy, but they don't have any control over long-term rates. That's driven by economic conditions, you see. And the Fed had been raising short-term rates all throughout the last 2 years. And, of course, in December, the Federal Reserve and Powell, the chair, got ganged up on by the bankers, investors, and Trump. And Powell did a 180-degree about-turn here in early January. Said, okay, no more rate increases in 2019, even though we were planning 3 to 4. And then a month later, here just a couple weeks ago, he confirmed that, saying, nope, no more rate increases for sure. In early January, he said, well, we're going to put it on pause. Pause meaning you might start it up again, right? But he confirmed now, no more rate increases. Well, that's all due to the pressure from the bankers and the government, the president, The president doesn't want higher interest rates because it's slowing down the economy and you got election coming up, right? The bankers don't want it. The investors don't want it. They want to keep the cheap money. So they're putting pressure on the central bank, the Fed, and it worked. Read my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I have two recent entries here of published articles, one that appeared in the European Financial Review in February called Trump versus Powell. How independent really is the central bank, the Fed? And then another one on the Counterpunch blog just recently, in which I entitled Powell Capitulates. Powell and the Fed Capitulates. In other words, gives up its own policy. You know, now, it's a fiction. It's a fiction in among academic economists that the central bank is independent. They want you to think that, you know. It's not influenced by politicians or bankers, right? And it never responds to changes in conditions in financial markets like stock markets. It's always concerned about the real economy, inflation, and employment in the real economy. Well, that's a big fiction. That's a myth. And the events of the last couple months prove that conclusively, that it's a myth. Central bank independence is a myth. What the central bank does strategically in terms of its shifts of policy is always done by influence from politicians and behind them, the bankers and investors. You see, it may look like politicians, Congress, or the president are the ones who are interfering with central bank independence, but it's the lobbyists behind them that are really doing it. You know, Trump increased his pressure on Powell in December because the stock market collapsed 30%. The Dow was down 30%. And the junk bond market froze up for the first time. They couldn't even issue junk bonds in December. You know, and the investors were pressuring Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. And Mnuchin called an emergency meeting of big capitalists to his office there right before Christmas. Emergency meeting. We don't know who those folks were, but, you know, they're the big policymakers, they're the big bankers, and who knows what big investors. It was almost a panic on the part of Mnuchin. He saw, whoa, this could happen. This looks like 2008 again, maybe. You know, he almost panicked about it. And that pressure, of course, was conveyed to Trump that same week. And that same week, Trump and others start calling, well, maybe we ought to fire. You know, they were throwing up these balloons. Maybe we ought to fire Fed Chairman Powell, right? Yeah. Well, they put big pressure on the Fed, and the Fed did an about-face because of the financial crash, proving, you know, smoking gun pretty much, proving that the Fed does change policy according to financial markets. It's not the real economy. It's financial markets. Yeah. Okay, so central bank independence, fiction, fiction. Federal Reserve never responds to financial markets, fiction. Fiction. And now the Fed is came to heel here, right? And the Fed, now the talk is, well, you know, if necessary, we're going to make some rate cuts. Yeah, that's on the agenda now. After 2 years of rate hikes, they're not going to just stop raising rates. Now the pressure is to cut rates, to stimulate the economy even further. More free money for investors and bankers before the election. You see how politics and economics of big money come together here? And that's where we're at. And, you know, that kept the stock market going too. Why? Because the investors borrow money cheap and invest in stock to keep it going. Stock and bond, financial assets, free money for since 1980s, it's been free money, virtually. central bank is involved with subsidizing capital incomes. It's not about stabilizing the economy with raising or lowering interest rates. No, no, it's about subsidizing big capital with super low, chronic low, long-term, cheap money, low rates. And that's what's going on here. Now, the rest of the world, central banks, follow suit as a result. Why? Because when you keep the interest rates low, or they're going lower, that lowers the value of the dollar, you see. And that makes U.S. export goods more competitive. So to protect against the competition of the U.S. Exporters and corporations, these other countries' central banks have to lower their currency as well. Or they're going to lose markets. Well, they lower it the same way, by pumping money into the economy and driving interest rates down. So now we see the EU and Japan and other places doing the same thing to keep their currencies low and competitive in a slowing global trade economy anyway. In other words, the pie is getting smaller and everyone's scrabbling and scratching to maintain their share or grow their share at the expense of everybody else. You know, that's a slowing global trade economy in which we're in. So the ECB, the central bank, European Central Bank, has done the same thing this past week. It did the same thing. It announced that it's going to drive interest rates even lower. Well, the problem is you have negative interest rates, negative government bond rates in Europe. And now in Germany, too, within Europe. Rates are negative. And they're going to go even further below. And they're negative in China. I mean, in Japan as well. Negative interest rates. Well, how low can you drive interest rates? Well, quite low. But the problem with negative rates is that it makes the banks, the private banks, even more fragile. So the ECB chair there, Mario Draghi, announced at the same time that he was going to provide more subsidies to the banks. It's called LTRO, long-term refinancing option. That's their version of QE, right? Pump more money into the banks, because now by lowering rates so that European companies can compete in exports and keep the euro low, we're going to subsidize the banks, you know, by giving them more money on the side. That's what LTRO is, right? Well, the European economy, you know, is stagnant at best. The EU is stagnant at best. All the indicators are that it's going further south. And the banks in trouble are not just the Italian banks, but now you see, as the water level falls, the rocks begin to appear, bank rocks here in Germany, you know, Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, you know, with Credit Suisse and in Switzerland and other banks in France, you know, Bank Agricole and others. They're all in trouble. And then now you got Brexit. And the banks in Britain are going to be in trouble. And Britain's barely growing, 0.2%. And that's before Brexit, which looks like is going to be a bust. Okay, so Europe's a basket case. Again, and Japan's not much better. You know, Japan, the forecast for Japan's first quarter GDP is also about 0.2%, slowing down rapidly. What about China? China. Well, China has pumped in a lot of money into its economy. It doesn't use QE. It's got other direct ways because the banking system is nationalized, right? Four big government banks over there drive everything. But there's a big internal debate going on in China right now about how injecting money doesn't seem to be working that much anymore. You know, monetary stimulus back 6 or 7 years ago in China got, for every dollar equivalent here of yuan stimulus, you got a dollar of real GDP growth. Well, now you got to pump in $4 in order to get $1 of GDP growth. So the effectiveness of monetary policy is declining everywhere. Everywhere. And the Fed stopping interest rates at 2.375, which is the federal funds rate for overnight borrowing between banks, that's the benchmark rate, now has very little ammunition to lower rates to try to stimulate the economy in a recession that's coming around the corner, getting closer. Yeah, 2.375, not much. And of course, the Europeans and Japanese got nothing. They're negative already. That 2.375 is also another yield curve flattening inversion. 2.375 is about where the 10-year rate is, the 10-year bond rate, and the overnight, can't get any shorter, right, federal funds rate are about the same. So that's flattened out and about to invert. By the way, yield curve has predicted recession when it flattens. It doesn't even have to invert, but a flat yield curve has predicted this last seven recessions, the last seven. Pretty good indicator. Oh, but you know, if you listen to the business press and the media and the talking heads, they're trying to talk that down. They're trying to say, oh, the yield curve is not a very good predictor. You know, it's predicted four out of the last three recessions. That's all bullshit. Bullshit talk to try to keep business confidence up. The truth is, it's predicted seven of the last recessions, including the big one in 2008-09. And it's predicting it again now. Well, you know, investors know that. And regardless of what the talking heads say, investors are moving to protect their money. They're putting it in bonds. Yeah. Right? They're buying bonds. Well, you know, when you increase the demand for bonds, like anything else, you increase the price. You know, increase demand, the price goes up. The price goes up, the rates go down, and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of the yield curve, rates going down. Okay. So watch this. We got a big rush to bonds. We got a bond boom going on, a government bond boom, safety. And that's the most important development of the past week. You know, we've taken a big step towards the next recession, I think, here, which I predicted would be late in 2019, first quarter at the most of 2020, but probably 2019 if the trend continues, right? Okay. So take a look at jackrasmus.com, my blog, for those articles which elaborates on this theme that I've been talking about with the central banks and the economies of the main, you know, the large economies of the world here, the U.S., Japan, Europe, and even China. You know, China is worried that its excess monetary stimulus is not only not having the effect it usually does, but the money that it's pumping into the economy is being lent to speculators. The speculators are buying up, are taking short-term loans, and they're using it to buy derivative products like asset management products. They're speculating. The money's not going into real production and real investment. It's going into financial asset markets. Shadow banks speculate. That's what the money is going. And that's a problem in the 21st century here for the capitalist, global capitalist economy in general, as I've talked about many times. You know, you inject money, the Fed injects money into the economy. And where does it go? Does it go to real investment, increase productivity, create real jobs, making real things? No. The money is diverted into stock markets, it's diverted in bond markets, financial markets, derivative markets, or it's diverted offshore. Or now it's clear that a lot of the money is going into merger and acquisition activity, M&A activity. Latest data just appeared is that M&A activity will reach $1 trillion this year. M&A meaning companies, instead of investing and expanding, simply buy up another company, which doesn't generate jobs. It usually ends up reducing jobs, because then they rationalize and lay people off where they have duplicate operations. Yeah, M&A is a job killer, not a job creator. So there's $10 trillion globally in negative interest rates. $10 trillion now in negative interest rates. By the way, that's up from just $5.7 trillion last year. So $4.3 trillion more assets that are negative, that are yielding negative rates. It shows you how fast the shift has come over the past year towards negative rates. Okay. Now, you know, some of this is a result of stock buybacks, some of this M&A activity as well. Corporations buying back their stock. That, by the way, is also what's keeping the Dow and the stock, NASDAQ and other stock markets up, keeping them from collapsing. The stock buybacks, you know, are either from selling corporate bonds and getting money that way cheap and then giving the money to your shareholders, buying back the stock or paying out in dividends, you know, or they've doubled down here in the last year by Trump providing big tax cuts for investors and corporations. On top of the cheap money, big tax cuts. You see, both subsidize investors. The cheap money subsidizes investors, allows them to issue low-cost bonds and use the money for, you know, shareholders, stock buybacks, dividend payouts, right? But so do the tax cuts. The tax cuts do the same thing. Now, here's an interesting figure here. In 2017, stock buybacks were about $500 billion. Last year, they were over $800 billion. So a $300 billion increase in stock buybacks. And we're not even talking about dividend payouts, which also increased. You know, in previous shows, I've been talking about, oh, you know, stock buybacks, dividend payouts, about $1.2 trillion last year. Well, no, I was wrong. I was underestimating. It's at least $1.4. And it's rising. In the last quarter of last year, it was at a run rate of $223 billion of stock buybacks just in the fourth quarter. That's $900 billion a year if it continues this year. And then we got another $600 billion in dividend payouts. So that's like $1.5 trillion of money going to shareholders. $1.5 trillion. And at least $300 billion of that is from just the corporate tax cuts in the Trump tax cut bill that was passed in January of 2018. And it's interesting, if you look at how much the U.S. Treasury corporate income tax revenue has declined, about $300 billion. $300 billion. Well, you could say, you know, $300 billion they kept, and $300 billion they either used for stock buybacks, or they're using it for merger and acquisitions or dividend payouts. You know, that's what capitalism has become. It's become a big money shuffling machine, a big subsidization machine. The state is playing a role subsidizing capital incomes like never before, and is doing it through monetary policy. Monetary policy is stabilization policy, what the academic economists say it is. You know, it is also a fiction. It's all about subsidizing capital incomes now, and so is the fiscal policy, the tax policy, subsidizing, which kind of means they can't generate the profits on their own, and they got to rely on the state to do it for them, the government, the state, which is doing very fine, right? Or if they are generating profits, they want even more, and the state's doing it. They're getting even greedier, you might say, right? Okay, so trillions of dollars in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, trillions of dollars of M&A activity, This is what's going on. All right, so continuing on, watch the yield curve. Don't listen to the ideological spin by business media. Right? This is very serious. Right? The only time the yield curve did not predict a recession was in 1966 and in 1988, very briefly. Every other recession we've had, the yield curve has accurately predicted, and especially the last seven. Okay, and it doesn't need to invert. It can just flatten out and you can get a recession. And boy, we're already flat and leading towards more inversions, you might say. Okay. Other events here worth talking about. The problem in currency, global currencies, has erupted again. Turkey, which was a year or so ago at the forefront of a problem of collapsing currency along with Argentina, stabilized its currency a little bit but now the currency is in free fall again. Well, why now? Well, it's because speculators are attacking the global currency speculators, investors, professional investors, are attacking the lira. That's the currency of Turkey. Well, why are they doing that? Well, they think they can make a profit by driving the currency down, a speculative profit, which they can. Well, the government there, Erdogan's government, has spilled the beans and said, look, you know, these are U.S. speculators who are at the forefront of this and are trying to destabilize our economy right before our elections, which come up here, I think, in a week or so, right? Well, why would the U.S. want to destabilize currency? Because, Turkey. Because they don't like what Turkey's doing politically. You know, Turkey is buying a Russian missiles, S-400s or 500s, I forget what, the latest missiles, instead of buying U.S. missiles. And that's freaking out the Pentagon. They don't like that. You know? Well, this is another example of how financial means are used in support of imperial interests. You know, you destabilize the currency. That's one of the first things you do to get these other countries to come to heel in the U.S. global empire. By the way, some really interesting data I just came across in a new book, How to Hide an Empire. I forgot the author, but worth reading. You know, what's the dimensions of the U.S. economic empire today and historically? But he pointed out an interesting fact that U.S. special forces, right, are in 143 countries. Special forces, you know, the Navy SEALs, Delta Force, all that stuff. You know, when Obama left office, there were 55,000 of them. Now, under Trump, apparently they've increased 20,000 more. Okay, 75,000 special forces, U.S. special forces, and they're in 143 countries. The U.S. has intervened in its history 211 times in other countries, invaded or intervened in other countries 211 times, according to this new book, you know, How to Hide an Empire. Well, I've been writing about the financial side, you know, the financial tools and tactics that are used to maintain and grow the empire. A short time back, if you want to go to my blog, jackerasmus.com, or this radio station, I talked about what's going on in Venezuela, how financial measures are being used to destabilize Venezuela. Well, it looks like the same thing is beginning to happen with regard to Turkey. You know, not as severe as Venezuela, but the U.S. is clearly trying to destabilize Turkey, and it uses the speculators, private speculators, to do so as well. Okay? So just keep that in mind. We'll watch what's going on with Turkey a little bit more here. Okay? And we'll watch what's going on with U.S. Special Forces around the world. Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing of interest is we've got a right-wing ideological offensive beginning to grow in the U.S., you know, attacking the whole idea of socialism and trying to equate socialism with social programs. You know, the Green New Deal or Medicare for All or whatever. This is socialism. Trying to give it a negative connotation, you know. I don't think it's working too well because folks really want those things. And we'll see what happens here. But it's not just that particular issue, socialism. They're attacking the Green New Deal. And also attacking free speech, using free speech to open up the universities here. Another new offensive. Okay. What else is going on? Oh, by the way, you know, if you want to hear a great defense of the Green New Deal, which is under attack in the business media and everywhere, Trump in particular, they're going to go after that and go after Medicare for All by misrepresenting what it's all about and claiming it's socialism, take away your freedom. You know, if you get medical coverage, Medicare for All takes away your freedom. And Green New Deal, the same thing. But if you want to hear a great defense of that, listen to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's statement here in hearings in the House recently, where the Republicans went after the Green New Deal and she defended it, you know, very elegantly, you know, with a little fire and spirit that you don't hear from Democrats, you know, typically. That's part of the problem with the Democrats. You know, most of them are wimps. Right, they won't fight for what they should believe in, what Democrats have always stood for decades ago, right? Most of them, you know, become moneybag Democrats, taking money from big lobbyists and corporations, of which we have about 35,000 registered lobbyists in Washington now. 35,000 registered. How many know? Not registered. Okay. All right. So let's watch this right-wing corporate ideological offensive beginning to take form. Beginning to take form, which will continue, I'm sure. Oh, here's a statistic I forgot to mention when I was talking about global negative debt, negative interest rates, right? Negative interest rates, total global debt. 22% of all global debt now is negative, is yielding negative rates, up from 13% just a couple years ago. So the global economy is slipping into negative interest rates, another indicator that monetary policy and interest rates are totally ineffective. Ineffective, which is significant for the next recession coming, right? The Fed can't do anything about it, can't lower rates. Well, what will the Fed do? Well, we'll see more QE, in other words, bypass interest rates and just give the money, print the money electronically and give the money to the banks and investors. More QE. The Fed and other central banks had accumulated over $20 trillion of QE-related money injections to bail out the financial system in 2008-09, over $20 trillion, right? Oh, and they were talking, we're going to take that money back out of the system called QT, quantitative tightening. Well, they didn't get very far, and they stopped. The Fed has stopped and said, well, we're probably going to have to add more, and so has the ECB. And the Japanese never said they would stop. They've just kept doing it. And I talked about how in China the money injections are producing more speculation and instability instead of real growth. I call that China's whack-a-mole economy, you know. They stimulate, since 2010, they've been stimulating the economy fiscally as well, but, you know, monetarily through the banking system in addition, and it's producing yet less and less yield in terms of real growth, right? But every time they inject monetary stimulus, a lot of it, as I described, gets funneled off into financial asset investing and speculation, you know, asset management products and local government financial vehicles and so forth. So China is, you know, sort of a stop go. Let's push you know, real growth by stimulating the economy with all this monetary injection, and that you know, provides fodder for the shadow banks and the speculators and investors. And then China says, oh, we got to stop this. This is, you know, wasteful capitalism. And they pull back on the monetary injection, but that slows down the real economy. So they got this trade-off, this dilemma, this trade-off. The more they integrate with the global economy of growth versus the speculators, right? They can't stop the speculators without slowing growth, and they can't generate growth without giving a boost to the speculators, right? And that's what's happening to China. And they're going back and forth, and over the long term, their economy growth rate is slowly slowing as they integrate to the global economy. And, of course, the U.S. Trade negotiators want that integration to increase. As I've been saying many times, what they want, the U.S. negotiators want, is a greater access to China markets, with a greater control of their companies in China, including bankers. Hmm? Banks weren't in China. Now they will be. And they want China to buy more U.S. goods, particularly agricultural goods, right? But mostly they want China to stop its economic development through technology. Slow it down, right? And the technology, of course, is military-based, right? We've talked about that. So the Pentagon is behind the hardliners, Lighthizer and Navarro, running negotiations. But sitting at Lighthizer's shoulder is Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, a banker representing banking interests. It's like a co-captain thing over there now. And both Lighthizer and Mnuchin have gone over to China, and they're negotiating right now with China. China, I predict, will make some concessions on paper with regard to technology, but it won't stop them. You know, they're not going to shoot themselves in the foot, right, and stop their technology development. Yeah. Well, Trump says, we're going to keep the tariffs on you, $250 billion of tariffs, until you really show us that you're doing it. Well, what kind of negotiations are those, right? We want you to make all your changes, and we're going to keep the hammer, even after the deal. You know, China would be very foolish to agree to that kind of negotiations. But that's the way U.S. negotiates, always does, right? We're going to sit down, and we're going to have a discussion with you guys. This is what we want from you. And once you do that, then we'll think about giving you a quid pro quo, you know, something in exchange for it that you want, you know, but we're not going to go, you know, in normal negotiations, you give something, we give something, let's, you know, go further, and you give more, we give more. No, that's normal negotiations. The U.S. doesn't negotiate that way, right? It says, here's what we want. When you do it, maybe we'll give you what you want, but maybe not. But by then you're tied into an agreement, right? Well, that's the way they conducted this last round of negotiations with North Korea. Very clearly, you know, the neocons did not want an agreement with North Korea on missiles and nuclear versus sanctions. No. North Korea had offered, you know, to dismantle four or five bases. I don't know what the details are there, but they had put forward, you know, an initial proposal in exchange for an initial reduction of some of the sanctions. You know, well, that's the way you start negotiations. Well, the U.S. response, the neocons, Pompeo and others running that show, where no, you got to dismantle all of your missiles and nuclear facilities and let us expect it and so forth, and then we'll think about maybe the sanctions. Well, that's not negotiations. That's an ultimatum. That's ultimatum. But that's the way the U.S. does it. Well, because it's their empire. It's the U.S. empire, and they are the gorilla on the block. And that's the way they've been conducting business of empire for decades now, and the way they hope to continue to conduct business. Okay. So we got negotiations going on over there. And as I predicted, you know, the deadline is come and gone that Trump had indicated. And they will keep kicking that can down the road and keep negotiating. And I think there will be an agreement, you know, maybe May, June. And it will appear on paper that China has agreed to do something about technology transfer and intellectual property. That's all the same thing, you see. They'll appear to make concessions on that, you know, but implementing it, I don't know. You know, especially they'll implement some of it, but they'll be very cautious, I think, in watching what Trump is going to do as far as the tariffs. You know, but hardliners say, no, we got to keep the tariffs. You know, that's the hammer, to make sure they abide by the agreement. Well, what kind of agreement is that? You know, if I were in a negotiation, as I had been many times in union negotiations with management, and management would tell me, well, you know, we'll think about giving you a raise, right? But you guys all have to work overtime on Saturday, and we'll see how hard and how well you work, and then maybe we'll give you a raise, you know? Would you agree to something like that? I don't think so. Right? Or, you know, if you all work harder and the company profits increase, we won't lay off some of you. Well, what kind of a deal is that? That's not negotiated. We would call that bad faith negotiation. You know, it would be an unfair labor practice. Right? You could walk out on strike just over that. You know, negotiate in good faith. Well, the U.S. empire does not negotiate in good faith. It never has. You know, you look at the whole history of relationships with the Native Americans. You know, you agree, they agree to a treaty just temporarily until it suits the U.S. interest to break it. And they kept breaking and breaking the treaties over and over again. Whenever, you know, gold was discovered in North Dakota or Montana, well, you know, sorry, we're going to shrink your reservation, right? Go after the gold. Let people go after the gold. It was just temporary. You know, the whole history of U.S. Indian 19th century relationships is just that, right? There was a time, for example, during when the Civil War erupted, the U.S. agreed to certain treaties, you know, with the Lakota and other Indians there in the North Plains, Cheyenne, and so forth. They agreed to the terms because the U.S. was sending the troops in, you know, to the South. You know, they didn't have time to deal with that. So a treaty was like a temporary truce to U.S. Invasion and offensives. And then after the Civil War, you know, there was an eruption of conflict there, and the U.S. For a minute looked like it was going to go after the tribes, but then it had the reconstruction in the South and was sending troops in the South, and, you know, they were demobilizing forces and so forth, and the quality of the, you know, the forces left was pretty poor. So they, you know, agreed to another truce in the late 1860s. But then once they had recovered and it was pretty clear that they were pulling out of the South, you know, that was the mid-1870s. Well, that's when they turned U.S. forces, you know, the mid-70s, 80s, early late 70s, mid 70s, late 70s, and cleaned up the reservations, went up there and threw them onto reservations for good. And then they just kept creeping onto the reservations and opening up, whenever oil, whatever was found there. And they're still doing that today. Okay, so that's, an example. You know, treaties are just truces, temporary truces for U.S. economic interests. Treaties are just temporary truces, And that's true, with regard to what's going on with China trade negotiations. They're to be broken when it is useful to do so. Another interesting development of the past week here was Trump has opened another attack on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. What's that all about? I thought that was put to bed and the courts had said that the Affordable Care Act would stay. The Democrats said, a big victory. We stopped him, now he's opened it up again. Well, he got one of his appointed radical right federal judges to declare the ACA unconstitutional as an opening blow here. And now he's going to propose to get rid of the ACA altogether again. Well, what's that about? Why is he opening up? Because, look, the ACA, as far as the big money was concerned, was a problem because it raised taxes to help pay for it in part. Yeah. How much taxes? Well, the ACA, $600 billion in taxes on the wealthy. It's investment tax, medical tax, investment surtax, $60 billion a year, $600 billion. Well, this is just another effort to give business another tax cut. After giving them over $4 trillion of tax cuts over the next 10 years, which was what the Trump tax cut was about, now they want to give them $600 billion more by repealing the ACA. That's what it's all about, you see. And there's other one-off efforts ongoing here, not at such great dimension, of cutting taxes further, technical rules and so forth that have been working their way through the Trump administration as well. This offensive on tax cuts has not stopped. As blatant as it has been, it's still ongoing. And that's what's behind the ACA. Well, the Democrats ought to use this as a great opportunity to push Medicare for all. Say, okay, you can cut the taxes. Let's get rid of ACA, but Medicare for all is the solution here. We're going to pass Medicare for all. But the Democrats have a big split in their ranks. And it's, evident not only in the case of healthcare policy, but in other areas as well. It's the money bag side, the corporate side of the Democratic Party that doesn't want to do this. And then the popular side, which is growing in voice here with, Ocasio-Cortez and some of the others, the new blood that want to go for it. Some things that really get people excited, like Medicare for all and free college tuition, public college tuition, let's do something about the, ridiculous student debt, et cetera. Those are things that'll get people interested out to vote. But now, the money bags don't want to do that because, they get the money from the corporations, then it'll be at their expense. So big splits in the Democratic Party, and you can see it emerging in whether to impeach Trump or not, and all right down the middle. And that will continue. Those divisions will continue. All right, what else is Trump doing? Well, the big news politically, I guess, was the Mueller report, wasn't it? The Mueller report came out here earlier last week. And what did it decide? Nothing. It didn't decide. It decided not to decide and to throw the hot potato onto Congress's lap, right, to decide. Congress is now fighting to get the true report in order to decide. And Barr, Attorney General Barr, in other words, Trump's puppet there, after he's driven out Rosenstein and Sessions, right? Barr's going to do whatever he needs to do for to protect Trump, right? Barr has decided to stonewall Congress and to force it all to the Supreme Court to decide. But they won't decide until after the 2020 elections and the voters decide. So it's kick the can down the road and misrepresent, this four-page memo as the decision of Mueller, and then come up with an extreme redacted version, 20 pages or 30 pages, who knows, as a concession, install and drag it all out until after the election. In the meantime, Trump will say, I'm exonerated. And the Democrats fell right into that trap, didn't they? Yeah, relying on Mueller and Russian collusion. They should have been going after Trump's financial deals. That's his real vulnerability, is tax evasion. We used to throw people in jail for tax evasion, but we don't throw rich people in jail for tax evasion. But that's what they should have done. Go after his foundation, go after his taxes, and so forth. Obstruction of justice. That's what he's done. Okay, so we'll keep watching what's going on with the decision here with Mueller, but the fix is in, very clearly, and by not making a decision and throwing it onto Congress to make the decision, Mueller has saved Trump pretty much here. Because now, with Barr in the driver's seat, it'll just be, the whole thing was fixed once they forced Rosenstein out, and Sessions, wouldn't participate. So they got Jeff Sessions out of there, and they got Rosenstein out of there. Put Barr in there, and now they'll say, we're for the report. Let's but which report, The four-pager, the redacted version coming, or the real thing? Pelosi and Democrats will never get their hands on that report in full totality here before the election. All right. So those are some of the more interesting developments politically and economically here of the past week. And we should keep our eye on the economic indicators in the U.S., next week we will have the report for January jobs that will come out, and we'll see what that actually says. Last month was only 20,000 jobs created, but of course, that was, they can argue, with some truth, that the data, was a problem here because of the shutdown. Although I don't think the Labor Department ever shut down. I think maybe the Commerce Department did, and its numbers, and the Budget Office. But I don't think, I could be wrong in that regard. But anyway, no one really believed the 20,000, but now we'll have a full month and maybe more accurate data. All the data revisions are being revised down here. The third quarter was over 3% GDP growth. And fourth quarter was 2.6, but they've reduced that, I think, to 2.1. And the forecast now for GDP for the first quarter of 2019 are about 1.2%. I'm talking about, J.P. Morgan Chase Research and banks and so forth. This first quarter is going to come in quite low, but they're going to say that, that's because of the shutdown. Nonsense. Shutdown had little effect on total GDP. But all the other indicators are, slowly beginning to sink. And you add that to the slowing global trade, slowing global economy, and big problems in Japan and in Europe and even China and India, then it looks very clear like we've got a drift towards recession at some point here going on. So let's watch the data. Let's watch the data. But keep in mind, you know, the data is not always quite accurate. The U.S. has been has a long history of when it doesn't like the statistic, it redoes the data and the statistic. And we see that clearly with inflation using chained prices, smoothing out and lowering the rate that way, changing the definition of GDP to give it a bigger boost a few years ago, right? Its inability to accurately forecast the gig economy and the missing labor force and discouraged workers, you know, redefining how many have been uninsured, coverage here, insurance coverage, you know, whenever the numbers get too high, changes in how it defines wages. Federal Reserve now going to change its 2% inflation target here to a kind of a smooth out target to make it look like it's reached its 2%. The 2% will become 1.5 or something like that now because they're going to change the definition, right? Changing the savings rate so it looks like we're saving more than we actually are. You know, these are all small but cumulative ways in which the data and the statistics are manipulated and smooth in order to make them look better than they actually are. But having said that, it's the, you know, pretty much all we got to work with, but just be skeptical of government statistics because there are problems with them. It's not a question of falsification, you know, it's a question of emphasis. But we'll look, watch very closely what comes in for first quarter GDP, first quarter jobs or last month jobs, and some of these other indicators, and what's going on in Europe. And of course, now we're going to have Brexit any day now. Maybe, you know, maybe they'll just continue kicking that can down the road, which is what I predict they always would do. You know, the UK is in an unenviable position. It can't get a respectful exit deal from the European Union, which can't give it to them because if it makes it look too easy to get out, that will cause the rest of the European Union to unravel. So, you know, the French and the Germans are making it hard for the British to exit. And it's kind of payback because the British have always been kind of arrogant with relation to the rest of Europe and control the financial EU financial system out of London and stuck it to, you know, the Germans and the French time and time again. Well, now it's payback. And the EU is saying, no, you're not going to get a good deal to get out. And you can watch Parliament and Prime Minister May squirming, trying to somehow get a deal that they can't get. And the question is, will they drop out hard Brexit and take their lumps? Or will they just keep kicking the can down the road and hope that they can get a second referendum, you know, later this year or next year to turn the whole thing around? In any event, either way, it's going to destroy the British economy. Okay, that's the show for today. And more next week, I'm sure. Walk the streets of screaming now.